Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is November 25th, and coming up on the show today, another, in my opinion, very enjoyable and educational conversation with Bill Buepert on the philosophy of Stoicism. Originally, I planned for this to be two parts, but it has now grown to three parts, and this is why. I'm a big fan of lists. You know, in marketing, they're always telling you, if you want the clicks, have little lists, you know, and you title them like 2 Wild Secrets, 7 Strange Things, 3 Crazy Rules, 4 Weird Tricks. And people can't resist. Well, I've been sucked into this. I love these lists. So I did a lot of prep for the show today, and really we got to almost none of it. We were going to talk about the ethics and the logic of the philosophy of Stoicism. Now, we touch on those things, but we really don't get into much detail. And I think that's something we should do for you in this introductory mini-series. But for today's show, I wanted to use one of these handy lists, 10 Themes of Stoicism, as first a review of what we talked about in part one, and then a jumping off point for our discussion in part two. But originally, I only thought it would take us 15 or 20 minutes to go through the whole list, and then we would move on to some of these more complex concepts, but it wound up being a majority of our discussion, except for the first half hour, or the first 25 minutes, where we have this discussion about objectivism and Bill's thoughts about it. Now, if you're one of those folks out there who says, Brett, enough about objectivism, I ain't into it. Because I went to one of their meetings once, and it was just a bunch of old men wearing black turtlenecks, and they stared at me judgmentally. And then when I told them that I was new to the philosophy, they started talking to me like a baby, saying, oh, you want to learn about philosophy, baby? Fine. You can skip to the 29-minute and 15-second mark, and that's where the discussion on Stoicism begins. Also, because there is a part three, that is where we will deal with all listener questions. I know I said I was going to get to an expansion of Sarah's question on women and libertarianism or women and anarchism. That did not happen in this show. It will happen at the end of the next show. So if you have questions, post them in the comments for this episode or in our Facebook group. Hey, are you in our Facebook group? Just search Facebook for School Sucks Project. You'll find us. So here we go. Here is part two of my discussion with Bill Buepert. Check him out at zerogov.com and on the Freedom Fiends now and then. Today's installment is titled Turning Adversity into Advantage. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
Trying to take a semester or two of college level rhetoric and put it into two, three, four hours.
Right.
So that's a difficulty we have. The most we can really do with this is do what's called a familiarization fire, you know, where we're giving everybody the rough edges and the table of contents.
Yeah.
And they have to read the book. So
yeah, that's typically been my approach. I never wanted anyone to feel like this is the be-all, end-all, like I will be your source and authority. I think now that's very useful from a marketing standpoint, and some people have been very successful with that. But I really have considered this show to be an open door into an exploration that people have to do, right?
Sure, because that makes sense.
And not that I'm that kind of figure anyway, but if everyone was always reliant upon me for answers, you know, that's, first of all, that's dangerous and kind of creepy. And that's not what I my whole presentation with the show is I'm learning too, and I'm recording myself going through that process. So,
but you know what? Maybe too, it speaks to the very foundational reason why you do what you do with School Sucks and why School Sucks.
Yeah.
By introducing them to the ideas and saying your vantage point of research and what you do spending your own time self-learning is where, you know, you're simply the entry drug for that.
Also, it's not prescriptive is another thing that's important to me. Like,
sure.
Most of what I've presented on the show has been through an objectivist lens. That was the philosophy that was the most appealing to me. I'm not saying to people, well, you know, now that we're going to do a couple shows about Stoicism, that means this abandonment of the philosophy of objectivism. The two line up in a lot of places. They part ways in a couple places as well. And, you know, people are left with a choice. I don't think philosophy is the kind of thing that you can treat like a buffet or a salad bar. That is also dangerous, you know, just picking and choosing what you want to believe. And then you're left with these glaring inconsistencies that don't really translate into a coherent philosophical package. But, you know, there's a lot of good things here, and people should at least be introduced to the basics of this, because like objectivism, it is a philosophy for living. You know, there's a lot of philosophies that exist like in a cloud off the earth somewhere, you know, like nihilism. But when I've talked to people who were, you know, consider themselves relativists or nihilists, I said, well, you know, what do you do when you're actually on earth, right? You kind of rely on the existence of
Interacting with other human beings.
Interacting with other human beings and interacting with the natural world around you where there are no contradictions, you know. Yeah. But as far as, you know, practical living, I think that this study has a lot of benefits for a lot of people.
Now, do you still consider yourself an objectivist?
I don't like to label myself an objectivist, first of all, because I think that comes with a lot of baggage. Like, people picture a certain thing when you call yourself an objectivist.
Like the word anarchist.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I still subscribe to the basics as far as, you know, going through the five branches of philosophy, even though objectivism, really a traditional objectivism, big O objectivism, drops the ball in the realm of politics, you know, the metaphysics of it, that there's a reality outside ourselves that we can interface with through our five senses, the epistemological, that we use our capacity for reason to make sense of those inputs, and, you know, the translation of an ethics of rational self-interest, you know, that all is stuff I still accept, I would say.
I flirted with it, but I don't think, like my dalliance with the Libertarian Party, it didn't last too long.
And what was it for you?
For me, it was Spooner, the Anti-Federalists, history, my pretty deep drinking of history, and I'd say Spooner and Rothbard were probably the Rand had an effect on me early on. But I object to three things with Rand. Number one, her complete dismissal of religion. And I'm not a religionist, by the way. Mm-hmm. Her complete dismissal as of religion as a way to form a moral compass. Her cultism that she practiced. And her almost absolute disregard for discontent.
All right, well, let's go one by one through those. And Bill, since I'm recording, I mean, we could maybe use some of this in the show. This is good stuff. If that's all right.
Sure, we could do that.
All right, so let's go through those objections to objectivism one by one. Religion. First of all, okay, I think there's two things there that are valuable warnings in objectivism. Number one is deference to a kind of arbitrary authority and collectivism. If we take it out of the realm of supernatural and into, like, say, progressivism, modern 20th century progressivism, which I consider a religion, we see how a lot of those dangers can play out in the real world. I think that there's a kind of derision against religion in objectivism that I'm really trying to get away from, because I'm realizing that, and people have called me out on this over the years, because I used to be really, really harsh, you know, on Christianity, Catholicism. I was raised Catholic. I experienced that. And people would say, don't you realize that you might have allies, you know, in this world, especially if one of your goals is alternative methods of education, you know, especially considering how much work Christians have done with regard to something like the Trivium.
And home education.
And home education, absolutely. So I think there's valuable warnings in objectivism about religion. But I do agree with what you're saying, that they are harsh in places. I mean, what was it for you that really rubbed you the wrong way?
Basically, it's when I started to read about the and I read a very what happens is I get caught up in historical rabbit holes where I'll go down somewhere and all of a sudden I'll say, well, I need to read several books on that. When I read about the Christian ascetics and some of what one could call Christian flirtations with Stoicism, And when I read about what the Romans did to them, and then all of a sudden the Romans just absolutely battered the Christian faith for hundreds of years, and all of a sudden it is the Roman faith. And I just asked myself, how does that happen? I mean, that was astonishing to me. And then I look at the Ten Commandments and I match them up against Kant's categorical imperative. And I think to myself, you know, there's a whole lot of similarity here, which can best be expressed by that hoary old cliche of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And to me, Rothbard and Spooner communicated that to me also, where they said that serving your own self-interest, for the most part, will always serve the rest of humanity, and that altruism, or let's say people who shill for altruism, usually it turns out to be a sham in which they're trying to direct you to do things in a fashion that benefits them and doesn't necessarily benefit the people they claim to.
Okay, yeah.
I know that sounds a bit tortured, but I think that when the Soviet Union ceased to exist between 1989 and 91, the only way anybody had a moral compass whatsoever after living under 70 years of Soviet atheism was the underground Orthodox Church and the influence it had on people, so that all of a sudden the state, to a large extent, disappears as they have known it all of their lives. What do they turn to as a practicum for how to treat others well, how to advance in a community, how to treat your friends and neighbors, how to treat your family, and what's the right thing to do? For them, it was their interpretation, of course, of the biblical text. The Bible, of course, being the Book of Abraham, which is the root document for Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, from which all the sects, S-E-C-T-S, sprang that we have today proliferated throughout the world. Now, is there religion that does tremendous harm? There's no doubt in my mind. Is there religion that does tremendous good? There's no doubt in my mind that there is. Probably in the home education movement, when we were doing it for nearly a quarter century, we were the outliers because we didn't do it for religious reasons. But I would suggest that if it weren't for the religionist participation in home education, it would have been much easier for the government to make it very difficult for me to take my children out of government school, and I owe them for that.
Sure. And I mean, this is the problem with religion, is because it's so broad that goes both ways, right? So we have in the 20th century all of these religious groups, you know, working to expand real educational options for people. In the 19th century, we have, you know, another group of very religious people looking to basically force everyone into the mold. You know, mostly Protestant, and their big fear is the Catholics. And this was a fear that existed in the country for over a century, from the first wave of immigration through the presidency of John F. Kennedy, who some of the younger listeners might not know this and might be shocked by this, but the only Catholic president, I believe, had to basically give a speech reassuring the American people that he was not going to be, loyal to the Pope. Over the country. So there was this fear of, you know, watering down the American culture through religion, and some religious groups, you know, the Horace Mann crowd, used the setup of the schools to produce a kind of homogeneity in that respect.
So, yeah, I agree with you. And it always baffles me, Brett, and I think we're talking about a subject here that is probably near and dear to your heart and the project that you've embarked on. Which is, why isn't it that the Mormons, for instance, or any number of Protestant sects, or the Catholics, for instance, who have already had a very vigorous and widespread influence in private schooling in America and in Europe, why can't they step out of their weird apocalyptic nationalism and their misinterpretation of Romans 13 and simply say, you know what, as Mormons, for instance, let's use this as the test case. They do something called seminary, where we have many Mormon friends, and I love having Mormons as neighbors, by the way.
Yeah.
But they do something called seminary, which is 1 hour, sort of like in my mind, they don't describe it this way. This is the way I describe it and observe it. It's a 1 hour antivenin against what that student is going to experience when they go to the government school for the next 8 to 10 hours, where they go over their religious texts, those things like that. The Mormons, and I think the Catholics too, but both of those organizations – have the chutzpah, the organizational savvy, and I think the ability to say all of a sudden, you know what? Because of what government schools do to our children, which is evident in their behavior and being away from their parents and such. As a church, as a community, we're withdrawing them from the government schools. We're forming our own schools, and we're going to do three things. Number one, if you can afford to pay tuition for your student in that school, please do so. If you can't afford to pay for tuition to that school, don't worry about it. Send them anyhow. And for those who can't afford more than paying the tuition, please help those who can't meet the tuition needs. As a church body, let's all group together, hold hands, and do this. I'll bet in some communities where Mormons are maybe in the majority or a large portion of a government school board or whatever the case, you know, with the way they have them locked down in their districts, they could make all of a sudden half the population of a government school disappear.
Yes. And I'm wondering, you know, what their alternative would be, you know, and not just even Mormonism, but indoctrination comes in many forms, obviously.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. But I have to think that why not have, instead of this one-size-fits-all Department of Education Soviet socialism that's practiced throughout the country, why not have a veritable market feast of different venues? You have home educators, you have unschoolers, you have religious home educators, not secular home educators. You have, you know, the Mormon private schools, the Catholic private schools. And all of a sudden, if the market has granted the ability to make people vote with their feet in their wallets, quite literally, it will have a breaking effect and a mechanism on the worst aspects, I think, of religious indoctrination and things like that.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Because there's no breaking mechanism today on the totalitarian nonsense that is American government schooling.
And there's one more thing. Just we mentioned Mormonism. One thing from my observation anyway, from what I know about the Mormons, they seem to still hold on to a concept that used to be much more commonplace in this country, and that's mutual aid, where it seems like a lot of other forms of Christianity have turned their back on mutual aid because the state has essentially pushed it out. There's a book, The Tragedy of American Compassion. Are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar with that one, yes.
Right, okay. So all of these social issues that today are addressed by the state were once addressed through religious organizations, but they've basically been crowded out at this point. The Mormons, maybe, I don't know. I don't even have a guess at why this is, but they seem to have maintained that.
I think they have, along with the Amish and the Mennonites.
Sure. Yep, absolutely.
You know, of course, any Amish or Mennonite community. And what's interesting to me, and this is one of those vexing questions, which are questions that I don't have the resources to address, but I think that if somebody took the time to tease it out, they could probably find some unified field theories among the Amish as far as liberty is concerned. Because, yes, they are a very tight-knit community bound singly by their religion, but they don't pay Socialist Security. And they managed to get by and get around so many government regulations. They've sort of broken the code on that, and I admire them for it.
Right, yeah. And there was one more note, just to bring this all together here, we're talking about objection number one to the objectivist philosophy, which was attitudes about religion. You did mention Kant's categorical imperative. The objectivists are very, very, very harsh critics of Kant. And I think one of the warnings about that, for those who are unfamiliar, this is basically the idea that act as if your behavior makes a moral rule for all people. Correct? Categorical imperative.
You know what? I think you could say that, but I think it could also be interpreted for those who are proximate to you. In other words, those you have an interface with all the time.
Sure. And yeah. There was a warning about that in the context of, you know, an authoritarian system that, well, whose behavior will make the rules?
I think Rothbard put that question to bed, and no one can accuse Rothbard of being an objectivist because he certainly levied his own both gentle and not so gentle criticisms against Rand. The one thing I don't want to do, though, Brett, is do the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea with Randians and objectivists, because if you're trying to set up a path to a stateless society, even though objectivists aren't stateless folk,
right?
If you're trying to set up that path, please go with the guts, and I like that. But some of the nonsense I've seen with their idolatry of militarism overseas,
oh my goodness,
just baffles me. It just baffles me.
And even historically, like with the treatment of Native Americans,
Yes.
Rand was an apologist for that. And then, you know, her heir, Leonard Peikoff. It was funny. We were talking about this last night, actually. There's this video of Bill O'Reilly calming down Leonard Peikoff after 9/11, like the period in between 9/11 and the beginning of the Iraq War, where he's talking about basically nuking the Middle East into glass.
I know.
Yeah. So, like I said, there's a lot of hesitation when it comes to calling myself an objectivist and saying there's things about objectivism that I like. Here's some places where they went off the rails. And we're probably going to see eye to eye on not just this first objection, but the other two that you have as well. So you want to go on to the second one?
Certainly. My second objection is that Rand had a cultish sense in which she thought that it was her way or the highway. And you know what? If you have some followers and idolaters, let's say a dozen or so, and that's the case, and they're willing to do so, great. But her quelling of dissent I found to be so objectionable and nasty that it would turn into a handbag fight that would lose sight of what they were trying to achieve in the first place.
That doesn't,
I think it compromised her vision.
That doesn't even need any additional comment from me. I totally agree with that. Have you ever seen Mozart Was a Red?
I did.
Oh, so for those who are unfamiliar, this is a one-act play.
You should put that in the show notes.
That would be absolutely. You can find it on YouTube, converted from either VHS or Betamax. It was a birthday party for Murray Rothbard where some of the attendees did a presentation of this one-act play that he had written about meeting Ayn Rand. There's a fairly young Jeffrey Tucker in it. I have no idea how old Jeffrey Tucker is. Sans bow tie, by the way. And it speaks exactly to what you were saying, this cult aspect of objectivism, at least when Rand was alive. And certainly the followership of Ayn Rand after she was gone, they do call for a very strict kind of adherence to what she said, which seems to...
And you find that everywhere.
Yeah, which seems to basically move away from some of the best aspects of the philosophy. Yeah, right? Like reason.
Absolutely.
You know, like just... Absolutely. And that was also the thing in their criticisms of like the German idealists that they were warning against, this deference to authority. So, I mean, I guess that happens. You know,
so on the one hand, they're warning against the deference of authority, but they demand it in the cliques.
Exactly. Exactly. So yes, it's hypocritical. Yeah.
And I guess my third objection may be a subset of why I find cultism so repellent. And that would be whenever you're around anybody who says you shouldn't question my authority. Actually, I'm not going to entertain that question. And instead of answering your question, they do it, but they do it in an ad hominem or fallacious fashion. To me, that sends up the most, I guess, loud alarms of all when somebody says, you know, just follow what I say and don't question it. Don't try to examine it. Don't tease it out. Don't try to tease out inconsistencies or ask me that important Socratic question of why.
Sure. And I don't even understand how, I mean, it's certainly not a mindset that I've ever been in at any point. No, I shouldn't say that because I used to be a teacher, right? But what that was about was fear of losing
control. Hi, my name is Brett.
Yeah, that was about fear of losing control. So while I say I can't imagine being a cult leader or the leader of some kind of movement and saying that, gosh, you know, maybe if my audience was suddenly 20 times as large and there was a following and I was considered to be this central figure in whatever that was, boy, I'd like to say that I could maintain this current composure and this current like sense of myself and in this place. But yeah, that kind of power and that kind of worship even could certainly change a person who's not ready for it. And, you know, reflecting on my experience as a teacher, it was entirely about the fear of losing control of what I had, you know, even though that was, there was no merit involved in that. It was completely arbitrary. I'm the teacher, you're the student. This is how it works. Don't quite. And I feel like I was even good about this. Like I would encourage questions because all I wanted when I taught history was discussion. All I wanted was to look out at a group of people who didn't look like they were bored or asleep. So I would invite a challenge. But I do remember at times where the challengers were just too persistent and I found that frustrating and would say, okay, well, we just have to move on. We just have to move on. You know, Thad did something like this when he was on the show, but I didn't take it this way. It's possibly an explanation for why people would do this. Thad had points that he wanted to make. We would get hung up on like some smaller part of a larger presentation that he was trying to do. And he would say, he did this on Joe Rogan too. He would say, well, everybody agrees on this. All the experts agree. Like, this is not where I want to stop. I want to keep going. I want to get through this. He has a point that he wants to make. So he doesn't want to get hung up on something that he sees as being maybe inconsequential or of minor importance compared to the bigger picture. But
which may be of critical importance, like Asimov pointed out when he said, imagine skyscrapers that are hundreds of stories tall and you have no concept of the elevator. As a result of not conceptualizing what may be something inconsequential, you start to extrapolate, well, obviously people would have to live near work. Maybe they'd have to live on the top 100 stories and commute to work on the bottom 100 stories, all because of your lack of knowledge of what could appear to be inconsequential elevators.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when he did it, I didn't see it as, you know, him trying to be evasive or anything like that. It was just an explanation for why maybe somebody would say, oh, well, don't stop it for questions here. But in the case of Rand and the Objectivists, yes, that was always like very, very unappealing to me because the philosophy was initially very appealing. And then I, you know, started to look into, okay, well, who are the personalities? And I was far less excited.
And that's where it gets ugly in my mind.
Yeah. One of the people that I work with very frequently, Wes Bertrand, is very well versed in this and is more than willing to point out all of the flaws in Big O objectivism. So he's been a real asset to my show and kind of, you know, taking like the objectivist work on logic and metaphysics and epistemology, separating it from all of the things that rightfully will turn people off to the large O philosophy.
It makes perfect sense. You know, it's much like the large L Libertarian Party. I want nothing to do with them whatsoever. I mentioned an earlier dalliance with them in the 90s. I was a member for 3 months, and I was so disgusted by just what I saw at my local level and the way they would compromise principles for electoral gain. And I thought to myself, what is the – as a matter of fact, I suppose, Brett, that may have been my entry into questioning why voting matters at all and why I've become a staunch and vocal non-voter and think that voting is a cardinal sin.
The problem with something like the Libertarian Party is it gets people too close to the political process, which I think is very dangerous. This actually, there was a big flare up here in New Hampshire where one of the quote unquote liberty candidates chose to go after his opponent by pointing out that she did not support the death penalty for a cop killer.
Are you kidding me?
Yes.
Wow. I'm opposed to the death penalty. I'm opposed to the death penalty on principle, and I'm pro-life when it comes to the unborn from conception.
So this was a nominally pro-liberty candidate who chose to leverage that against his opponent. My opponent thinks, you know, it's okay to kill cops, and I support the cops. Well, then, you know, you're doing
amazing.
This. Yeah, this really happened. And all I could say is, like, this is not, you know, a crazy person, or this is not somebody who's really a statist masquerading as a libertarian. That would be incredibly frustrating. This is somebody who's gotten too close to the political or electoral process, and they're making bad decisions because of that. Because, I mean, what else
can
you
do? The ring of power.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I saw. So, all right. Well, that's a good running start for us today, Bill. We build this. Go ahead.
If I may, sorry to interrupt. I just want to say that I am not a Spooner authority. I do think I've read a lot more Spooner than most people have. I think I can say that with authority, and that's all I can say is as far as being a guy who knows Spooner. I think the more Spooner becomes an influence on people's thinking, much like Rothbard, there are going to be schisms and Protestant sects that will come from that, where you'll have adapted Spooners or maybe relaxed objectivist or whatever the case may be. That is a natural human condition.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So transitioning into our part two of the discussion on Stoicism, we left it last time saying that we would move into the ethical and rational aspects of the philosophy this week. You wanted to discuss the eight moral lessons.
And I wanted to discuss the 10 themes of Stoicism before we do that you were kind enough to send me.
Right, absolutely. So I thought this would be not only a good review, but a good introduction to our part two, going through these 10 themes of the philosophy, and I can read them one by one, and we can discuss each one a little bit.
Super. Let's do that.
All right. So number one, recognize what is under your control and what isn't under your control, and don't worry about what isn't under your control. This is like super, super important.
I probably bored your audience last time when I listened to the podcast you and I had made together, part one of this one of two parts, mm-hmm. where we talked about stoicism, because I noticed I kept using the phrase span of control, and I may have overused it. But I do think when it comes to stoicism, it is one of the central tenets. There are four cardinal virtues in stoicism that Seneca and Aurelius would tell us, and that is courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. Mm-hmm. Wisdom, as a matter of fact, in the trivium quadrivium sense, that those who are longtime listeners to you, Brett, you probably schooled them on rather adroitly. So it's that kind of wisdom. It's not the wisdom where you're a smart aleck or anything like that. It's the wisdom of your experiential database, what you've been exposed to. You've read 3 to 5 to 10 to 20 to 100 books on a single subject, which sort of makes you expert in something. It's what Gladwell talks about with that 10,000 hours of doing something makes you a master of doing that thing. Mm-hmm. And that's all about span of control. For instance, a concert violinist who becomes one of the top 10 violinists on planet Earth after Gladwell's 10,000 hours of practice, after extensive reading into the craft, after tuning and having the best violin they could possibly afford and making do with the best one they can afford because they may not have that Stradivarius. What they've done is they've taken this whole Stoic span of control business and they've said, everything within my control is me mastering this craft to the extent where I am better than most people at doing this. Now, this could be sheetrocking. This could be playing a violin. This could be doing podcasts like you, Brett. This could be Rothbard, who wrote what seemed to me thousands of books, but I know he wrote hundreds. You know, as long if you do something with an almost Japanese eye to doing that thing well, and you continue to hone that craft to its finest edge, all that's within your span of control, because you're certainly not going to be able to play the violin as well as you do if it weren't in your span of control. Mm-hmm. Now, take the case of that violinist. Should they be concerned with saving the whales or doing something like that?
Right.
Certainly they can do that. Can they stop whale slaughter and cetacean mammalian slaughter, as awful as it is? They can make an effort, but it probably would be outside of their span of control to do that.
Sure. So there's extremes there, right, that we're talking about. On the one hand, yes. in the under my control category, doing the right things in the attainment of a goal. On the other extreme, things not under my control, saving the whales, right? But then there's things that are, like, in my opinion, closer to the middle. And from a lot of what I've read, body, property, both come up on the list as things that are not really under my control. Reputation was another one. And I think that those things are more in the middle of the extreme, right? Of the extremes we laid out. It's not really black or white, is it?
You know, I agree. And for those in your audience who have seen the movie The Last Samurai, you'll remember, and I'm paraphrasing, the American protagonist in the film, played by Tom Cruise, mm-hmm. was saying something to the effect of, whether they are archers or they build swords or whatever the case may be, that single, somewhat banal craft is taken to the next level because of their attention to detail and their dedication to doing it right every time. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned in part one that it was interesting to me the intellectual stovepipe developments of Bushido and Stoicism, where they had no relationship nor discourse with one another. You had the Greco-Roman heritage and then you had the Japanese. Yet you find so many similarities in what they're trying to achieve with ultimately, we're going to talk about this, I think, probably with some of the other themes, that sense of serenity and tranquility that comes with not only having grasped what your span of control is, but by doing well and right with one thing you can do better than anyone else.
Right. Yeah, serenity is obviously very underrated, I think,
yes,
in our society.
In our electronic age, yes, because reading doesn't take place until you take your eyes off the page. And I look around me today, Brett, and I see people so electronically tethered and involved in the moment that I think to myself, when do you contemplate and reflect? When do you just take the time to set all your electronics down, look at the beautiful sky above you, and just think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is a very stoic thing to do.
And we've mentioned so many times on this show the Serenity Prayer. This is basically the essence of that, recognizing the things you can control. Wait a minute. I got to pause and think of how it goes. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's number one.
How stoic, Brett.
Exactly. Absolutely.
What you think about that, it is.
Yes. Do you want to move on to number two?
I do, indeed.
All right. Conform your will to the divine order of the universe. Some people might be a little uncomfortable with some of the language here, but that can be fleshed out a little bit better.
Even an atheist can say, the divine spark is very intriguing. The divine spark could be whether they acknowledge they have a soul or not. It could be that unique configuration that their mind is that makes them the individual that they are. And they don't have to refer to it as a divine spark, and that's what this is referring to. I mean, if I said this in my mind, it would say, conform your will to the divine spark that is you in the order of the universe. That's how I would modify this to make everybody comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Religionist and non-religionist alike.
For me, I think that this really seems to be about gratitude too.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like what, you know, focusing on what you've achieved, what you've earned, instead of like an incessant longing or a comparison.
Yeah.
The third one, understand your emotions. Don't repress. Okay, this is actually a very important one. Don't repress or assent to all emotions.
This is a business where people say that person, when they use it in contemporary parlance, they'll say that person's very stoic, where they conflate that with emotionless, or he'll take a beating and he keeps on ticking, but you can see that he just has resolve and he's not letting his emotions get in the way. I would suggest that when you read Seneca and Aurelius and Epictetus and all the rest, they aren't saying to repress your emotions so much as to use them in a fashion that advances your own personal growth and not one that is destructive to either your growth or those people that you have around you.
You know, I think I really expected a question like this from the audience regarding needs and emotions, accepting them, understanding them, and the importance of doing that. I do still think that in the 21st century, we live in a society where men are basically told not to have them. Now, there's kind of an interesting contradiction there, because if it's like a positive emotion, oh, he's so sensitive. But if it's an inconvenient emotion, it has to be silenced, you know?
And this is conjoined to the notion in number four that we're going to go over right after we finish addressing this.
Sure. So I would think there's a bit of a danger here in this philosophy, just translating for men who aren't being careful into a repression of the emotions.
I agree. And it's like you said earlier, Brett, you and I are simply guest lecturers in a 101 course who are introducing the right. students, your audience, to all of these concepts. And I urge everybody, please purchase Gregory Hayes' translation of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. Seneca, Epictetus, don't worry about how old some of the books are that are available used on Amazon. You could put a Stoic library together very inexpensively. And read it all. I mean, it's amazing the broad panoply that is Greco-Roman Stoicism. And as you've mentioned with William Irvine's book and Ryan Holiday's book, there's a Neo-Stoic movement too, which I think, by the way, thank you, Brett, you're starting to stoke with these shows. There's so many layers to this onion to be peeled back that you and I do a disservice to if we say we can teach you everything you need to know in the time we're going to take on this podcast.
Absolutely. In number three as well, another resource from more modern times, are you familiar with Albert Ellis? Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy. So there's a bunch of like great little books by Albert Ellis that you can find. 21 Ways to Stop Worrying. That he wrote maybe 25 years ago was one that I had. But he's written a number of books on this.
Well,
subject.
He wrote one that I have in my library called How to Stubbornly Refuse to Make Yourself Miserable About Anything.
Yes, yes.
So, yes.
So that's just a more modern resource, maybe for some people more practical. But I definitely recognize the importance of getting the foundation as well. So number four, doing the right thing no matter the cost.
And you know what? When you say something like that today, in American society, if not European society, it seems to me you could go to jail for doing something like this. And the answer to that is yes, you can. Yes, you can. For instance, there's that 90-year-old World War II vet in Fort Lauderdale who's been arrested and fined several times for feeding the homeless. There is a man who provides a very contemporary example, weeks old, of a man who said, you know what? Even if I'm going to be finding, kidnapped and caged, I'm still going to do what I think my moral compass directs me to do. As a matter of fact, if we talk to this guy, and maybe he's not a stoic, but I'll bet if you ask him, well, what are there any threats that the authorities can offer you where you would stop feeding the homeless? I know this is presumptuous, but I suppose his answer would be no.
Yeah.
So to me, he provides a great signal contemporary example of that. Gandhi provides that example. In my mind, Spooner provides that example. To a lesser extent, I really think Rothbard provides that example. Rothbard's been a tremendous influence on my intellectual development, more so than Rand. And it cost him professorships, much like von Mises.
Sure.
And they refused to say, you know what, I'm going to compromise myself intellectually and do the left thing instead of the right thing, and then I'll get my professorship, and then I'll get my tenure, and then I'll get the accolades, and then I can party with John Maynard Keynes.
And maybe Rothbard, who was making those choices 30, 40 years ago, lived in a somewhat safer world with respect to the relationship between the quote-unquote citizen and the state. Today, doing the right thing can be deadly. Now, obviously, if everybody lived by this, if everybody did the right thing, no matter what the cost, the state, you know, the state would probably go away.
I think the state would cease to exist. It's like Eric Frank Russell's book, novella called "And Then There Were None," where he talks about very briefly this imperial ship with colonial administrators and soldiers goes to a planet that has yet to be imperialized.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the novel, because they are myops, mind your own business, by the end of the novel, they can't do a thing because all the soldiers have deserted and half the bureaucrats have.
So the question would be then, how do we balance this in today's world where most people, with respect to their relationship to the state, are not doing the right thing? They're not doing the most self-respecting thing. Very few people are doing that.
You know, and I'm the first one to admit to moral cowardice, Brett, because I pay taxes and I abhor them.
So how do we balance this theme of stoicism with something like self-interest? You know, because
this is going to sound like a cop-out, but it's inevitable, especially in a country as unfree in America, even where the airwaves are monitored to the extent that they are. And this is a postcard to the NSA.
Mm-hmm.
You and I could be fined, kidnapped, caged, maimed, or killed, depending on the level of resistance, just for saying people should stop and violently resist the predations of the government.
You could
lose your show. And we're not saying that, by the way. I'm focusing that to the NSA and all the people who are listening. We're not making that statement because this is not a free country in which the First Amendment means anything. We don't have free speech here, despite what you and I are doing today. There are very vigorous constraints on what is publicly acceptable thought in the government's eyes. But to your question, what would happen? The state would cease to exist if everybody did this very thing.
And in the meantime, I think when it comes to doing the right thing, no matter what the cost, pretty high up on the list of the right things has to be the preservation of one's own life, right? So
it does, but I'm intrigued by the third bullet underneath do the right thing no matter the cost that you sent me.
Mm-hmm. Conforming your mind to reality will lead to virtue.
I mean, unpack that. We could spend an hour.
Right.
Just talking about that. But what it's basically saying is it's saying that you can bend the reality around you to conform to your virtue and your moral compass in one very particular way. And I illustrated this last time on part one of this, the other podcast, where I said that there was a Stoic philosopher who was called before the royal court. He refused to do so. The emperor threatened him and said, well, I can have you killed and have your corpse dragged before me. To which the Stoic philosopher says, you will certainly have my corpse, but you won't have my consent. To me, that sort of vivifies what that third bullet reads.
So it's through practicing the principles of Stoicism, through action, through acceptance of circumstances, maybe even through something like influence, reality around you can conform to
absolutely
your mind. Obviously, we're not suggesting that in any magical sense, as others have done, but through primarily influence, right? And everything that comes before that in being able to be influential without, you know, threats of force or the use of force.
Well, you know, there's going to be a single-digit percentage of psychopath and sociopathic people in society. Most of them are in politics today. Hmm. And in government organizations, or in any number of really brutal arms of the government, like either the military or police, they're very comfortable there because they can live out what their true treatment is they'd like to mete out to the rest of humanity. And the government gives them a legal cover to do so. But I do think that's a single-digit percentage.
Yeah.
I think that most people really want to do right by their friends and families, as flawed as their decision making may be with the imperfect information that they have. I do think, I mean, very rarely can I look at my small extended family and my direct progeny and such and say, yeah, he woke up this morning and said, yeah, I'm going to screw somebody over and I'm going to try to do worse things I can to everybody around me and I'll sleep soundly at night. I don't think most people are built or wired that way. But I do think there is that single digit percentage of folks who are attracted to state-like activities,
you know,
do the opposite.
I think it's even smaller than that. And by that, I mean, as far as people who actually say, yep, today I'm going to fool everybody and I'm going to, you know, go out there and at the expense of others, get what's mine. I think that even if that is the impulse or even if that is the result, almost nobody is saying, I don't think Hitler said that, you know? And
I think they rationalized it to a
absolutely
certain extent.
And even when we see groups like, you know, in the Britain in the end of the 19th century, like the Fabian Society, and other groups that have this megalomaniacal impulse, or individuals rather who have this megalomaniacal impulse, they're telling themselves stories about how they're descended from Merovingians, you know.
That's
like,
right.
they're trying to come up with some supernatural explanation for this megalomania. So it's very, very few people, I would think, who actually say, look in the mirror and say, yep, I'm a bad guy. Here's today's to-do list. Here we go, you know?
So would you say that that being the case, this is so interesting, Brett, because you're bringing out some thoughts here that I hadn't contemplated before. When I look at span of control, I think of it in both a positive and normative sense, where if people do think their span of control is limited in that fashion, maybe most of the people that you're referring to are the ones who say, do the right thing no matter the cost to me.
Mm.
No matter the cost to me. Whereas status would say, do the right thing no matter the cost to everybody else, which means that they don't recognize span of control.
Right. And there would also be, I think, a utilitarian kind of argument. Greatest happiness.
I would say Malthusian.
Sure. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Greatest happiness for the greatest number being, you know, the chief priority, and along the way.
Another commie boilerplate.
Yeah, a few eggs are broken, but the omelet
yes.
will
That's
eventually
right.
be ready, you know? Yeah, I feel like I didn't completely answer your question, though.
Don't worry about it. That, you know what? It's the unanswered and the vexing questions that stick in people's minds, and somebody in your audience or you and I sometime in the near future will come to a conclusion.
Fair enough. That's a nice segue to number five. Understand that events are not problematic. Rather, it's your thinking that makes them so. Adjust your beliefs and expectations to fit reality. Now, I really like the first sentence there. I don't love the second one. And this maybe has a lot to do with where I'm coming from and what my philosophical influences have been so far. But yeah. that first sentence, very Zen, you know, that's a concept that definitely shows up in Buddhism. You know, it's not, things are not good or bad. Thinking makes them so. But the adjusting beliefs specifically to fit reality, I'd like to hear more about that.
I am reading a book, the third book that I've read by James Horn Fisher, who's probably one of the best naval historians in the last 50 years, called Ship of Ghosts, about the USS Houston.
Mm-hmm.
USS Houston was lost in 1942 in the Java Sea in Indonesia, where the Asiatic fleet was annihilated by the Japanese. And this is somewhat tangential to the bridge on the River Kwai, which has a whole lot of artistic license and not much historical grounding. But they were on the Burma-Thai Railway. there were American POWs, Dutch POWs, British POWs. When you are a Japanese prisoner of war, an ally who's a Japanese prisoner of war, you are stripped of every vestige of the humanity you had in the Western world. You're left with very little. There's talk of men dropping from a frame of 185 to 75 pounds. There's talk of men looking like walking skeletons. Mm-hmm. Malnutrition was the order of the day. There was beriberi. There was dysentery. There was all these kind of things. So there's a doctor there by the name of Hekking, H-E-K-K-I-N-G. He was Dutch. The Indonesia was a Dutch colony at the time and had been for several hundred years. He was raised by his indigenous grandmother to know the natural medicines that occurred in the jungle, unlike the medicines that were practiced by most Western medical practitioners. Mm-hmm. He sailed – well, I won't say sailed. He exceeded the in his success rate of keeping his prisoners, you know, those under his charge, alive and relatively healthy, relatively being the important term here, in this rather rapacious jungle, which took its toll on everybody because of those diseases that I just described, the monsoons, the malnutrition, all that stuff. He used the skills and adjusted those skills to what he had at his disposal. I mean, these people didn't even have bandages. And then you had the case of another POW said, you know, this is awful where I am, but he made himself into something of an amateur naturalist where he was in the jungle. Those who have been in jungles and what the progressives like to call rainforests, life is plethora. I mean, the life is just astounding, both flora and fauna alike. So he took to cataloging them, and he took to and he's living under the worst conditions imaginable. So the reason I use that as an example is here we have probably one of the worst conditions a human being can live in. And they're saying to Ryan Holiday's book, The Obstacles Away, my being a prisoner is an obstacle, but I'm going to use that obstacle to advance myself as a human being within my span of control. And that's why I use that example.
Okay, yeah, that makes perfect sense. And adjust your beliefs is very vague when it's first you know, shows up there. But what it's speaking to is adjusting your beliefs about the situation. You know, you find yourself in a certain set of circumstances and you say, what exists? You answer the question honestly, then maybe the follow-up question would be, what are the opportunities?
Exactly. And they're having a tough time matching up to the first three hierarchies of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But much less everything else that comes with affluence. They have no affluence, yet they have the moral turpitude and will to continue in circumstances that are just absolutely horrific. For instance, Ernest Shackleton, his Antarctic expedition, where they're marooned for 3 years in the Antarctic, he stands as one of those few leaders in human history who really did tackle this whole stoic lesson plan, as it were, all of these themes you and I have discussed today and before, and he uses them to such utter advantage. He and his crew leave that ice 3 years later, once they're rescued, better than they were when they started.
Yeah.
Psychically and morally, I think.
Yeah. So it's the difference between, when it comes to that adjustment of belief, maybe the question, what opportunities exist here, versus the declaration, poor me. You know, that's two completely divergent paths.
You know, I lost my job in September. Mm-hmm. So instead of moping and wallowing in self-pity, I went to Seneca, and Seneca said, start your own firm.
Yeah.
So I did. And that's what I've done. And I'm trying to get that off the ground as we speak. My wife just started her own business and we paid cash for the business. She's a permanent makeup artist, and she does micropigmentation for medical patients and things like that. She learned the craft. She opened up her own studio. She's doing that. We've done this with no loans whatsoever, because we consciously wanted to make sure that we simply did this in the most, I guess you could say, Brett, we tried to do it in the most stoic fashion possible, sure, where we owed no one but ourselves. And I'm going to see where it takes me. You know, if I'm not successful, the journey will make me wiser than I was before I began.
Absolutely. I can totally identify with that.
Look, the hour I spent with you last time in the podcast, and I'm certain that after actually 2 hours we spent last time in the podcast, which was delightful, and the time I'm going to spend with you today, I'm going to come out of this having learned something I didn't know either about myself or about stoicism as a result of my interaction with you, Brent.
Yeah, I'm in exactly the same boat. You want to move on to number six?
Let's do it.
All right. Number six, live with compassion and respect for human rights. And what I gathered, and it says this in the slide as well, is that there was this belief that every person, and there was this question that followed, how does this change your attitude about all the people you come across if you believe that each person has this divine spark, which is usually what it's referred to, in them, that other people are not just obstacles in your life, that you have this and they have this as well. I mean, the divine spark, again, vague and open to interpretation, I think, today. But this is a really important concept that follows the first five, I think.
I think so, too. And you know, isn't it eerie? And maybe I'm projecting here when I say this, but I found it so eerie how aligned Stoicism is with my own personal creed of abolitionism. Mm-hmm. Now, all of us as human beings, as cognitive thinking creatures, have varying bars of evidence and confirmation biases built into us. In other words, as libertarians, you and I usually have a bar of evidence that's slightly lower for fellow libertarians telling us how bad the state is.
Sure.
And we always demand that the state give us a much higher bar of evidence, and we inculcate a much higher confirmation bias when they're trying to convince us why what they do by depriving us of certain things is good for us in the long run.
That is very, very true. You are
it is. And I think the same thing applies here. But I have to say, when I strip this out and I try to think this through, I do think that the association with abolitionism and what people conventionally call anarchism and Stoicism is long, deep, and unrecognized. Some people say that genius is making a combination of new things that have never been combined before. Mm-hmm. And I'm not laying claim to being the first guy to say, hey, Stoicism and anarchism, there's a lot of relationship here. I'm going to explore that. And I'll bet I'm going to find in my studies for my book next year that people have already trod this path. And I'm going to use that to my advantage and leverage all the work they've done already to prove that point. But that is my thought experiment. As a matter of fact, that I guess you could call that my debate resolution, that granted, libertarianism, anarchism, and Stoicism are very closely aligned. And as both a lifestyle and a philosophical creed, they're almost indistinguishable in the moral ends that they seek.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, and even just with this specific theme right here, the concept of rights or liberties, there's been no greater predator in the history against that, you know, than the state.
Than the state. There has not.
And
live with compassion and respect for human rights.
Yeah. And another thing that comes up here is humility, you know, as part of this compassion and respect for human rights. There isn't a lot of humility in statism, right? And I think people have pointed this out about libertarianism. How will you
ask
do
your
this?
Local cop? Mm.
Yeah, but even on the larger scale, or even you know, ideologically, like, there isn't a lot of humility in statism. Like, here's the thing that will solve this problem for millions of people that I've never seen before and don't know anything about. That's crazy. That's like how an insane person talks.
And hold on, wait. If I may interrupt very briefly, Brent, it's so amusing to me when you say that, because it's like, well, people can't govern themselves. Got it. Mm-hmm. So we need people to be governed. But you're saying that if people can't govern themselves, you want people governing millions. What?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I think that's an important thing. Libertarians get sucked into, and anarchists, you know, any label you want to apply to this, a lot of us are sucked into the same types of questions from people who support the state. And that is, okay, well, how would you do this? I was watching this video last night of it was on this show called Real Time with Bill Maher, and Ben Affleck and Sam Harris, you know, the actor and the neuroscientist, yes, famous atheist, uh-huh, get into this big argument over Islam. Ben Affleck is just clearly, you know, outmatched by, you know, Sam Harris's intellect. And at one time he becomes very frustrated and he says, what do you want to do? You know, what's your answer? Right. And it's like, I'm not interested in hearing any more about how you know more than me about this thing. Do you have answers? And I think anarchists get these questions a lot, like, OK, smarty, how would you do this for millions of people? And sometimes the humility of saying, well, I don't know, you know, is
exactly
it's important not to get sucked into, like, you know, urban or economic planning if that's not your area of expertise.
You know, look at you and I. You and I have both been teachers
yeah.
in different systems, but mm-hmm. we've both been teachers. It is the rare teacher who uses Socratic drilling, but it's also the rare teacher who will stand up in front of their students and say, I don't know about that, but let's entertain some suggestions.
Absolutely.
Why don't we try to tease this out?
Right, because if it's anything else, it's like, oh, well, that's easy. You probably didn't think I had thought of that, but I have a very clear answer. That's if the purpose of debate is to hopefully exchange and develop new ideas, you're robbing the other participants of doing that. You know, when we really I don't know how to create a healthcare system for millions of people, and I'm happy to admit it. I don't think I could make an education system that would be good for millions of people, and I'm happy to admit it. But to say that, I think, opens a door in a conversation that could be beneficial for everyone involved. But a lot of these.
But I would say, Brett, to say the opposite, to say that I know how to serve millions with a healthcare system or an education system, mm-hmm. to me, that is the highest degree of hubris.
Yeah,
more
exactly.
More so than saying, you know, more than saying I simply don't know. You know, my answer to this whole national socialist healthcare madness is that it's none of the government's business to even participate in that.
Oh, well, absolutely.
Of course, that goes across the board for me. But this whole notion that they have the answers and they'll be able to do it with modern medicine and such, it's specious.
Let's move on to the next one. Number 7, cultivate right thinking through daily activities like meditation, contemplation, reflecting, and journaling. So we touched on this last time. But one of the most important aspects of the meditation was the negative visualization, right?
It was. And another thing I want to touch on very quickly was, how many people, because this talks about anger in the sub-bullets, were, you know, because the YouTube video, Seneca on Anger. Here's my question for you and the audience is, how many times have you been angry at somebody and then you apologize to them afterwards?
Oh, certainly many times.
And I the same. Mm-hmm. I the same. And I'm certain your audience would answer the same to us. You know, what you've basically done through that anger is you realized that you were wrong in one fashion or another for being angry. And that's why you go and apologize to them mm-hmm. for doing that. And the other thing too is from an Austrian economics utilitarian perspective, you've wasted a lot of time on nonsense.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's why the Stoics are so concerned about that, because for them, they consider anger to be wasted emotion.
Yeah, and well, there's two ways to express that, right? Either to yourself or somebody else. One, of course, is I'm so angry at you. But the other one, the really dangerous one, is to say you made me so angry.
Which means you're a puppet.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yes. Oh, and puppetry is another. And of course, Seneca or Aurelius don't call it puppetry. They called it whatever they wanted to use as a variant on the use of that word that we, you and I would use. But puppetry is an important aspect of Stoicism where we want nothing to do with that.
Right.
I don't want to be somebody's ventriloquist dummy or vice versa.
Absolutely.
It bears repeating. Daily activities like meditation, contemplation, reflection, and journaling. I think the reason journaling is mentioned here, and you're a writer, mm-hmm. of course. I'm a writer. My writing, I have one published book, and I maintain a pretty active blog, and I write a fair amount. Writing makes my thoughts clearer to me. It also acts as a braking mechanism on thoughts that have gone off the rails or awry, so I can think them through in a Socratic fashion and come to a better conclusion than I would have if I simply discussed it.
Yeah, any way of tracking what goes on in the mind, I think, is extremely valuable. About a minute ago, you said you're a writer, and I said, but I'm really not. I dread writing. I don't even like writing emails. I mean, I do it, but there was a time before this medium existed, you know, podcasting or that, before I had a way into doing podcasting or video production, I would write because there was nothing else available to me. And I think I was pretty good at it. But today, I just dread it, writing anything long form. I'd rather either use video or audio as the medium to express that. But before we started today, I was telling you about this program. You were familiar with this program, but Evernote, that I use.
Yes.
And I have it open because that's where I keep the notes. And I can kind of scroll through it and I can see basically the output of my mind over the last 16 months, right? Like I can see this horizontal, everything that I have devoted any time or thought to has a title. All the things I've done, you know, I have a list, things done. And, you know, there's, I don't know, I'm guessing 300-400 things here. I can see every project that I'm working on. I can see, you know, all of this research that I've done. Just having access to this provides a tremendous amount of clarity. You know, I know what the current projects are that I'm working on. I can see the vertical of those projects. You know, I can go horizontally across them, one project, two project, three project, four project. But then I can see the vertical of them too, like everything that that project involves, all the notes I've taken, all the little things I've scratched down, all the little thoughts that might relate to that somehow. And
I really need to invest more time in something like that, Brett. I use something called Scrivener as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like that, in which it provides me with, it does this great thing where I can write chapter by chapter. I can plan out my book. I can also put in my research topics on these cork boards, virtual cork boards and things like that. And of course, best of all, it compiles it into whatever format I want, like Mobi for Kindle.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But Evernote just seems like a hugely powerful epistemological management tool.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, you know, the once you figure out how to use it best for you, like if I ran into somebody, I mean, it's this fast. If somebody said to me, Brett, what did you do on your birthday this year? Okay, well, my birthday is August 7th. I make a to-do list every day. I had a meeting with Kevin Geary. I drove to Kittery. I called my brother. I sent an email to Joby Weeks. and I took my vitamins. You know, like, I know I did that because I have it right here as a checklist. You know, and that's for every day since then and many days before that. So there's all kinds of ways to make this useful for connecting to other people. Like, I could just tag any time a note, like anytime I think of, you know, something to do with Bill Buport, I just tag whatever that thought is, Bill Buport. And when I talk to you, I can just hit that tag and see everything that went through my mind related to you, you know, which could be very useful.
I think that's great because you're at last using this vast horizontal vertical information depot that we have that no other human has had access to on the internet and using it in a way to advance humanity instead of retard them. And I use that in both the variations of the word retard.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is value in actually writing things by hand. I think that's a different kind of experience that I would like to get more into.
It is because I'm an inveterate note taker.
Yes.
As far as making notes of what I want to get done the next day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And having them physically right in front of you. Like I can switch right to a different tab or window in Evernote. I can close Evernote. I can shut my computer down. But sometimes, you know, just a handwritten note on an index card, it's a different kind of experience. It has a different kind of use. And I think that's important too. But also keeping a handwritten journal. Obviously, it's not searchable. It's not taggable. But I think that has its place as well. I recommend certainly people carrying a capture device with them at all times.
Yes.
So
preferably a Moleskine notebook.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I've seen those. They're very nice.
Yes.
All right. So that covers number 7. Number 8 is understand that the external world is determined, but you have inner freedom to choose your attitude towards these determined events. So this is not, just to clarify, this is not a free will versus determinism debate going on here. It's both.
Not at all.
Right.
And there's two subtle variations to when it reads that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to repeat it for the audience, if I may. Understand the external world is determined, but you have inner freedom to choose your attitude towards these determined events. What Stoicism speaks to here is two different things, which is that it's hard to change the sky, the flora, the fauna, those kind of things. You must adjust to what their verities are. But on the other hand, it's also saying, I think in a more subtle fashion, that everybody, whether they acknowledge it or not, acts in their own self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
Even the altruist act in their own self-interest. So that's the kind of interaction that this is talking about here, is that just assume you are dealing with self-interested beings. Now, for Austrian economists and libertarians and anarchists and abolitionists, you and I take that almost as an article of faith, mm-hmm. That's the case, even with the psychopaths and sociopaths who inhabit the state. You and I both know they are acting in their self-interest. That's why they do what they do. Now, is it beneficial to them and everybody around them? Not necessarily so. But if we recognize by knowing what their bias is and knowing what our bias is, we'll be able to optimize our existence more rationally.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
This also harkens back to the concept of serenity, right? Because what this is really speaking about is we live in a deterministic universe. We live in a world of cause and effect.
Absolutely.
One of the bullets here, I think, is also worth talking about. More forgiving of others since they are controlled by forces beyond their understanding. I've gotten some criticism sometimes from situations. I can remember a few interactions that didn't go well, right? And afterwards I said, I think everybody did the best with the tools they had available at the time, you know? And some people like that, some people didn't. But it was true, you know? It was true. Nobody went into that action wanting to do poorly. Nobody went into that interaction wanting to hurt anyone else. But it happened, right?
And that's also a matter of maturity and wisdom. You know, your interactions with – do you have children, Brett?
I don't, no.
Well, I have 5 children, and my interactions with my children have varied over time as they've grown older.
Yeah.
I do want to hold to the conviction I have that all statists are adult toddlers,
mm-hmm.
because that's the way they view the world. But I think the rest of us, for the most part, in this small community that you and I inhabit, are in a position where we know that our behavior does have an impact on others, our self-interest does have an impact on others, and what capitalism does and the system that you and I embrace does is it says, you know, I may have to forego present consumption for future return. I may have to forego present pleasure for a return of a greater pleasure in the future by investing and nourishing the growth of a garden of love, a garden of investment, whatever the case may be.
Sure.
You and I both take a long-term interest in the way things work. And I think that that is what it speaks to a certain extent, because it talks about forgiving of others, for instance, forgiving other people's anger. Why would you forgive other people's anger? Most likely, with few exceptions, it would be in your interest with friends and family to do that very thing. And maybe even take the time to examine and say, you know, anger is really a wasted emotion. Do you know why you did that? And if you know why you did it, maybe you could prevent it from happening in the future.
Yeah. And there's an investigation that could be done there, right? When I said, you made me so angry, or I'm so angry at, it's a projection. It's the missing of an opportunity for an examination, right? Obviously, that strong negative emotion is about some unmet need, right?
I agree.
So I think becoming more of a master of these passions, that was another thing I learned too, that passions was not you. I mean, we use passion today to mean things that could be, you know, negative or positive, usually positive. I'm very passionate about this.
Yeah.
For them, it was more negative. It was more about kind of the recklessness of emotions. And I think that's important to point out. But in an effort to gain more control over these passions as they used it, I think it's really important to, you know, kind of slow down and be willing to do an exploration of what's behind it.
So to tease out what may have caused it in the first place and why you're doing that in the first place, and maybe, and Stoics would ask you this, what will you achieve if you do the following thing?
Exactly. Yeah. The question that I think a lot of people ask is, well, why is Bob such a jerk? You know, but the more important question, because there's no, when we're talking about things we can control and things we can't, we've asked a question that's out of the realm of, you know, action for us, or out of our sphere of control. But why does Bob upset me is a question that leads down a path that could be very productive.
Which, why do I let Bob upset me?
That's another.
As a matter of fact,
sure.
When Bob has a tantrum and I just react in a placid, calm, and even smiling fashion, does that disarm Bob from what he's trying to do?
Interesting. Yes.
Yeah.
Ah, look how nicely that leads into the next one. Number 9, calmness, humility, discipline, and indifference to pleasure and pain. Because of their worldview and training, the Stoics are calm in the face of adversity.
Indeed. I mean, that to me, it speaks for itself. And I've tried to, as a guy who spent most of his adult life in the military, you find that stoicism is a good trait to have. It's a good place to be because of what you have to do on a daily basis, especially in a combat zone.
Right, right.
And also because you want to die well.
And again, this is calling back to the negative visualization, being prepared.
You want to review that negative visualization process for those who didn't listen to part one or just need a refresher?
Yeah, absolutely. My understanding of it was essentially a meditative practice where we picture things going wrong and asking ourselves what we would do in those scenarios. Or if we were suddenly deprived of something that was very important to us, or even something that, you know, currently we need was gone, how do we move forward in the absence of that thing? And
I mean,
putting yourself into as real of a scenario, you even suggested in the last show, practicing these things. Like, I think the example you gave was like a weekend without electricity.
Yes. Just and you know what? It's up to people's imagination, mm-hmm. what they can come up with for this as far as that. And another thing to keep in mind with all of this is you ask yourself, well, what's the utility of that? I would ask people in your audience to reflect and ask yourself this. Man, we had hard times then. I did the following but are you better off today as a result of having passed through that adversity? And to me, from my own personal experience, and this is anecdotal, that adversity and failure, and I've had plenty of that, it teaches me a lot and sticks much better than success does.
Yeah, I think it's something that has to be a conscious practice for me. I realized at some point in my mid-20s, just through, you know, some life events and then some subsequent reflection, I said, wow, I'm kind of a dramatic guy. You know, what's that all about? And I realized that I had been so influenced by like entertainment culture, you know, like television. Like I spent a lot of time when I was growing up just in front of the TV, you know, watching sitcoms or dramas. And this was another conversation I was having recently with somebody, I don't remember where, about the movie Teen Wolf, which came out when I was like 9. And yeah. I was like, wow, those are the coolest guys. I want to be like those guys. Using this fake world as a standard for real world behavior. And I think there was like looking back and like journaling on things that happened to me when I was younger, all the way up until I think I was like a young man in college, seeing adversity as like, oh, here's an opportunity to be dramatic, you know, and like never realizing it in the moment, but reflecting back on stimuli and then the response, or really not a response. A response sounds too thoughtful. The reaction to whatever that stimuli was like, wow, you know, I really didn't have the best models. I mean, I had good models available to me. I would describe my father as very, very stoic, but he wasn't around a lot. So yeah. I was kind of learning about social interaction and response to problems through a completely fictional world. And that affected me negatively, right? It wasn't like, oh, here's adversity. Let's remember to be calm. And I think we see a lot of this in the world.
It's so interesting you mentioned that about your father being stoic, because that's my same observation. I came from a very poor background. Mm-hmm. We had tires on our roof, as a matter of fact. And we were poor, and I think we were, to a certain extent, natural stoics, much like I think Celts are genetically anti-authoritarian. But there's natural stoicism there. And also, I think there's certain religious denominations that have that. For instance, all of the monk factions that you have, especially in the Catholic Church, when you look at the Amish, when you look at religious factions like that, for whom discipline, humility, and becoming spiritual practitioners makes them into what I think are natural stoics. And I'll illustrate it this way. I have this pet theory where I think that those who came from nothing and made money and their children were raised during the time when they went from the time they were paupers to the time they become princes tend to know how wealth is created and tend not to be left or collectivists. Mm-hmm. Whereas those who are born into money, like the Kennedys, they never saw the money grow. They thought it grew on trees. I think they're more attracted to progressivism because they have no natural antecedent nor observation whatsoever of how wealth is created because they think it grows on trees.
Right. It's basically, that's what I was going to say. They talk about money. And the Kennedys, in my opinion, are not even close to the worst example of this, but I take your point as if it's a natural, an endless natural resource with about the same amount of regard that most people think about water or air.
Yeah. And by the way, that's a very tenuous example, and I'm happy for the audience to engage me and say, you know what, that's pretty lousy, but here's a better one.
You know, I always thought, too, when I saw the liberalism of affluence, you know, in pop culture, the progressivism of the affluence, I should say.
Yeah.
I always thought, it's a really interesting point that you make, because I always thought of it as like, okay, I make $17 million a year, of which $9 million goes to the federal government. I have to believe that they are good. I have to believe that they can have, this is my religion, right? That they will have a positive influence on the world as long as I send them a check for $9 million this year, right? Yeah. So it's this failure to look at the reality of government because, I mean, the same failure that I would have, I think, or the same difficulty, not failure, difficulty I would have looking at an institution that I just gave millions of dollars to. Once somebody points out that that institution is harmful to humanity, I would have a hard time with that. I'd like to think I could persevere through that discomfort, but most of them don't seem to be able to do it.
I agree completely.
Yeah. So, all right, on to the last theme of Stoicism, number 10, stop whining, turn adversity into advantage. And it points out here that this is really built on the previous nine themes.
And we've spoken to this. And you know, one advantage, Brett, of you and I discussing Stoicism is that there's so much that's been written on it that's so good from 2,500 years ago to recently. Mm-hmm. I'd mentioned in the previous podcast, Ryan Holiday wrote a book, and he's something of a phenom because I think he's in his mid-20s or early 30s or something like that. He's written a number of books. Wildly successful guy. He wrote a book called The Obstacle is the Way. And you can see from the title, you know, what that's about and what it means. And he goes on to make some very interesting examples of why that's the case. You and I discussed it a few minutes ago where we said that it's our failure and our adversity that tend to be the best teachers and tend to be the best providers of wisdom, you know, true wisdom, not simply knowledge. But wisdom being knowledge weaponized, in my mind, where you can make it good for yourself and those around you. That's how I view wisdom. And I think that that's what this all comes down to in number 10 with stop whining. You know, stop complaining about what the Stoics would say is a gift of adversity given to you, that if you fight through it, you will be better at the other side.
Yeah. You know, I can understand both sides of that, right? The whining side and the turning adversity into advantage, because I feel like in different situations or, you know, large and small things, I've done both. But when I look back at just say like the last 15 years of my life, it seems like you're compelled to do the latter. From the present day, I look back at the results of the last decade and a half of my life. It was turning adversity into advantage, right? Because I was, you know, somewhere 15 years ago. Now I'm here. It's a better place. There was adversity along the way. And I think that's natural, don't you?
I do. You know, Brett, may I say that you just said turn adversity into advantage. Mm-hmm. That's Brett V saying what you've done is you pretty much summarized. We didn't even have to talk for the last hour and a half because you've summed it all up for the audience with that very pithy phrase. So you know what? I do think that turning adversity into advantage, that's what all of this leads to, because guess what? You can never escape adversity. Right. No one can. Millionaires, whoever you are, do million and billionaires get divorced? Of course they do. Do they have difficulties with finance? Of course they do. Do they have difficult decisions in which they have a worse and a worst and a better than worst decision in front of them? And that's all they have? Of course they do. Especially, of course, exasperated by living in a statist world. As we do, where they make everything worse than it has to be.
Reminds me of this. You know, one time something my dad said to me, I forget, it was some problem that you know, I was seeking his counsel for in my life. And he said, Brett, somewhere there's a homeless woman with a drug problem who just found out she's pregnant. And somewhere else, maybe not too far away, there's a man who just got the wrong shrubs delivered to his mansion from Japan. And they feel that their problems are equally as bad.
I love that.
And he said, maybe the man with the wrong shrubs thinks his problems are worse, right? And that means that, you know, he's obviously not good at dealing with his problem. You know, he's kind of speaking to, he's not stoic. And I don't even know if my dad knows what that word means, but that was what he was driving at, right?
I get like, the sense that your dad and hundreds of millions of other human beings sense, if they don't intellectually know, why stoicism is so practical.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's like my wife was, to use a tortured allegory, my wife is what I call an instinctual libertarian and always has been ever since I met her.
Mm-hmm.
Intellectually, not a libertarian, didn't even know what it meant when we met for the most part. She's very bright, but she didn't pay attention to that stuff. But she knew in her gut, in her intuition, that government is wrong across the board, but she couldn't explain to me why.
Yeah.
So I think people are instinctually – I think good people – I'm gonna emphasize that. I think good, virtuous people are instinctually stoic, where they either practice a lot of what you've described, you and I have described today, or maybe they aspire to.
Absolutely. And that, again, speaks to the value – I mentioned this, I think, in the last show, of making things explicit, right? Identification,
yes.
Putting labels on things, and then remembering. I mean, once things are identified, especially if they're practices, it's easier to remember to do them, you know? Because, I mean, there's lots of times in my life where I look back at what I did and I said, well, that went okay. That went well. But to actually develop a process, a practice for, you know, either working towards goals or dealing with adversity. So much of what we've talked about here, the labels are really, really helpful, I think.
I think so, too. You know what? We've spent the time together today, Brett.
Yeah.
And we didn't cover
eight
moral lessons from Stoicism that I wanted to talk about. So I was wondering, and of course, because you can edit this, Brett, you can take this out and say, I'm not doing that crap. we should do part three, I think.
We should. There might be some more in-depth conversations that we could have about the ethics, the logic of Stoicism. I know we just touched on that last time.
I'd love that.
And maybe more listener questions.
I would love more listener questions and more interface with what they, because they help us keep track of making sure that we're not being dull.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. One note, regarding listener questions, I did feel like my response to one of the questions last time was a little incomplete, and I wanted to go into more detail with that on the just what I would distill down to the women in anarchism question, but we can cliffhang that. We can do that.
Let's do it
next time.
You want to do it now? I don't mind doing it now.
No, let's let more listener questions come in, and
we'll do that.
Then maybe we can take the last 15 minutes of the third show to wrap up with that.
Okay, terrific. This is pretty exciting, isn't it? Stoicism.
It's very.
And I really
exciting.
Think you. I'm excited that you. This sounds like a hoary cliche. I'm excited, Brett, that you're excited about it, but I find it so essential. To me, it's sort of like when I found abolitionism and I finally crossed that Rubicon from the silly notion of limited government, which I think is imbecilic, to where I'm at now. This had a similar impact in my life. And I've been this way for a while, you know, been a recognizably stoic and knowing why I am, but to share it with somebody else who seems to be really enthusiastic about it as you are, just it makes my heart warm. So,
and I'm really happy too that there's a lot of people out there in the audience who really want to learn more and really want to embrace it. It was one of the top suggestions that I got when I told people that I was going to have you back on the show. So yeah, and we've got plenty more to do, and I look forward to it.
Well, great. Thanks for having me on, Brett. It's always an honor.
My pleasure.
How many times have you heard someone say, if I had his money, I could do things my way, but little they know that it's so hard to find one rich man in ten with a satisfied mind. Once I was winning in fortune and fame, everything that I dreamed for to get a start in life's game. Then suddenly it happened, I lost every dime, but I'm richer by far with a satisfied mind. Money can't buy back your youth when you're old, or a friend when you're lonely, or a love that's grown cold. The wealthiest person is a pauper at times, compared to the man with a satisfied mind. When life has ended and my time has run out, my friends and my loved ones believe there's no doubt. But there's one thing for certain, when it comes my time, I'll leave this old world with a satisfied mind. How many times have you heard someone say, if I had his money, I could do things my way. But little they know that it's so hard to find one rich man in ten with a satisfied mind.